Welcome back. To start off our afternoon session, we've got Professor Kate Brown, who's a chair in social science at the Environment and Sustainability Institute. And Kate's going to be talking on the theme, How Resilient is the Cornish Community?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm very sorry that I couldn't join you this morning. I was teaching, and for those of you that don't realise, we actually teach a master's course here in Penryn on sustainable development. So I was teaching that. So there are a group of students who are very engaged in issues around sustainability and sustainable development and who are actually very interested in sustainability in Cornwall. So I called my talk, Is Cornwall Resilient? And not so much that I was going to answer that question, but that I wanted to pose that question to you, and I hope we can maybe discuss it after I make this short presentation. So I just want to say a few words, firstly, about what is resilience. Secondly, about what we know, and certainly some recent work that actually one of my master's students has recently finished, looking at community resilience and asking people in Cornwall how resilient they think they are. And thirdly, to reflect really on how Cornwall might be made more resilient in the future. So firstly, I think when we think about resilience, we firstly think about the ability to withstand shocks and this capacity to bounce back after an extreme event, such as, of course, the severe storms that we experienced here last winter. The definition that I really like of resilience is actually a definition from the Rockefeller Foundation, who have this big program on 100 resilient cities around the world. And they talk about resilience in these three different dimensions. So resilience is the capacity of individuals, communities, and systems to survive, adapt, and to grow in the face of stress and shocks, and even transform when conditions require it. So it actually makes resilience more than about bouncing back. It's actually about ability to shape, to be able to deal with future changes, future shocks and future stresses. It's about adaptation, but also this much more transformative capacity as well. And I think that's quite important because very often we just focus on the capacity to bounce back and deal with and cope with shocks. And if we actually go back to, the scientific meanings of resilience, then actually it's about maintaining a set of system functions and identity in the face of disturbance. And especially, I know you've been talking a lot about sort of cultural heritage and identity dimensions of sustainability. And I think we can see that resilience is quite a useful concept, both as it's used sort of, in popular debates, but also as a scientific concept. And that's what I work on, that's what I'm interested in. So, are Cornish communities resilient? As I said, one of my students, Lucy Faulkner, did a survey of about 300 households in two communities in North Cornwall this summer. So, remembering that that's, within 6 months of people having experienced a very severe winter. And so this is just some of the preliminary results from that survey, which I think might interest you. So when asked whether or not they agreed with this statement, my community's level of resilience is high, more than 84% of respondents either agreed or strongly agreed with that statement. And in fact, only 2% of the respondents disagreed. So we have there a sort of really strong sense amongst communities that their communities are resilient, okay? But of course, what we found is even just looking at two communities, there were quite significant differences and quite interesting differences, particularly, and I'm purposely not telling you which communities these were, particularly given the fact that one community had experienced a really quite extreme and devastating weather event in the last decade, and the other one hadn't. So, what were the important characteristics for community resilience amongst these respondents to our survey. Well, these five factors are in importance, okay? So the most important thing that people identified in contributing towards community resilience was place attachment. So it was their sense of place and the connections that they felt with their community. And I think that's a really important finding, actually. Secondly was community cohesion and efficacy, so the extent to which people actually felt that they were able to contribute towards and to build resilience amongst in their community. Thirdly was the networks, and particularly the kind of social capital and networks that they were able to utilise. Fourthly was the knowledge and the learning that they could undertake and share to build resilience. And actually the least important factor was leadership. And again, that was something that had quite marked differences between the communities, although the ranking was the same. And I think this is kind of important when we start thinking about what interventions might build resilience at a community level. So just to give you a few more details on this. So what other things affect community resilience? What were the other things that people mentioned? Well, here's 10 factors that people felt were important and affected both positively and negatively the resilience of their community. So people talked a lot about community fragmentation, and particularly about this, that in some places, in some coastal communities, they felt this split between permanent and temporary residents. So here's a quote. Second homeowners who only want to make a profit and rent their property out rather than being part of the community were seen to be, you know, adding to this fragmentation and undermining community resilience. Identity was seen as an important factor. People talked a lot about the way in which they felt they were able to have a say in decisions made about their community, and that the kind of lack of voice and the lack of power that they perceived, they thought had a very negative impact on their community resilience. So, for example, there is too much separation between people at the top and those at the bottom, and local people seen at the bottom and not feeling that there were really effective ways in which local priorities could be voiced around decisions which affected them. The economy was seen as important, of course, and in different kind of scales. And also this issue about communities' ability and willingness to respond to change. So I think this is quite an interesting comment. The community struggles with change. It lets things die rather than change its patterns so that it moves with current societal trends. So again, I think if we're thinking about, you know, the role of cultural heritage and things, what aspects do you want to keep the same and what aspects do you want to change? And, you know, I think this was really interesting, that there was in some places perhaps an unwillingness to embrace change. So lack of access to community assets, and then youth. That, you know, of course, part of the resilience of our community is about the way in which young people can participate, and particularly how we can keep young people in our communities. That's our future. So we need to keep youngsters here, and the opportunities for younger people to live here are getting less. Okay, people identified that as critically important. Employment opportunities. People talked a lot about the environment and especially about flood risk as being critical factors for community resilience, but also highlighted these kind of differing views about the future and the fact that they felt that many decisions were made on the basis of short-term political expediency that overrode real local need. So again, I think that's a sort of real challenge for how decision makers can engage with a process of prioritisation and how that might help to build this sense of resilience within communities. So that was some sort of very interesting insights in a way into how people just in two communities along the coast in North Cornwall feel about their own community scale resilience and about what they can do and what might help them to build resilience. But if we think about resilience in these three ways of being not only the ability to respond to shocks, but also to adapt, to change, and also to start to shape and transform for the future, then how can we build this capacity to shape future resilience? And that's one of the things that I'm interested in. And although I realise that a lot of you have been talking about the past, I actually think that linking the past to the future and thinking about, well, how does that help us to face the future is absolutely critical for sustainability. So I want to just tell you briefly about an exercise that we've undertaken here in the ESI. Two times now when we had our launch day and when we had an open day earlier this year, which is working actually with young people from Cornwall, year 10 school students, to use scenarios to look at different options for the future in Cornwall. So thinking about how people in Cornwall are growing up in these uncertain times, we wanted to think about how we could open up imaginations to consider and to evaluate alternative futures and to think about how we can build this capacity and agency to actually bring about transformation to sustainability for the future. So we did a very quick scenarios exercises where we based, you know, we devised four different scenarios of the future just based on two big global drivers of change. On the one hand, climate change, so either high or not so high climate change, and then on the other hand, the global economy. So the state of the global economy. So we just could define very crudely four different alternative futures, okay, based on high climate change, low climate change, economic collapse and economic prosperity. Very broad brush. You know, we used hard data to define these, but we wanted to say, look, you know, here's just four different ways the future might play out. And then we worked with a local artist called Joe Salter to present these fantastic sort of representations of the future. Remember, we're talking to 13, 14-year-olds. We wanted to present these images in a way which, you know, these teenagers would really engage with. So we used, you know, sort of graphic novel-style representations of these different futures. And Joe based characters on real people and an awful lot of detail about environment, technology, energy, transport, food, things like that, buried within each of these. And then we asked these teenagers to think about what these scenarios would mean for them and what it would mean for Cornwall. So we asked them to think about, well, a name for the scenario, and they worked in small groups on each of these different scenario representations. You know, what would Cornwall look like? You know, what does the landscape look like? What sort of farms, what sort of government might we have? You know, how would your family and your own life change? You know, by 2050, you know, you'd probably be about the same age as your parents are now. You might have kids about the same age as you. What would they do? You know, what would they be playing with? What would they be reading? What sort of jobs might they have? What would they do for entertainment? You know, would there be new health issues? So we kind of explored all of these issues. What would school be like? You know, and it was really, really interesting. And we then asked them, right, which do you think is the most likely scenario? And I have to tell you that nearly 100% of them chose the most dystopic scenario. They said it's going to be the high climate change, the economic collapse. If I just go back, it's this one in the top left-hand corner that most of those teenagers said, that's what we think's going to happen. That's our future. But when we asked them which was the most desirable future, interestingly, they didn't say the bottom right-hand corner, which is, in essence, the low climate change and the economic prosperity one. They said this one. And this one's much more about self-sufficiency. It's about going back to the land. It's green, and you know, it's about actually engaging locally, not having, you know, no fossil fuel-powered transport at all in this one. Really micro-scale enterprises, micro-scale energy and things. So it's very interesting that there was this, you know, big divide between, on the one hand, where we think we're heading, and on the other hand, where we'd like to go. And so then we asked them, well, what can you do? What can we do to avoid the most likely scenario and move towards the most desirable one? And of course then you got the fascinating insights into the agency that young people think they have or they don't have in changing this future and moving away from, you know, this very negative and dystopic view of the future. So I really feel that those are the kind of methods that we can use to start building resilience, not only to cope with the things that we have to deal with now, but also to think about how we shape a more sustainable and a more resilient future. So some of the things that I think, you know, this might involve, and again, you know, we can reflect on this in the context of sort of cultural heritage and the things that really matter to people in their communities. As well, firstly, we can avoid these so-called maladaptive responses, which are the things that we might do now to deal with the things, you know, the extreme weather and other disturbances and events that we have to deal with now, but which might, in the longer term, actually make us more vulnerable because it might lock us into certain paths, particularly kind of, you know, high technology paths. So we have to think about, well, what are those long-term, short-term trade-offs that are part of the decisions that we make now but might be closing down options for the future? You know, if we build a sea wall and if we invest multi-millions in a sea wall, what's that actually stopping us from doing and how is it going to help us in 10, 15, 20, 50, even 100 years into the future? We need to think about actually how that works across different scales, spatial scales, and how responding to one identified change might affect our capacity to deal with another. So again, if we think about, you know, just responding to one type of climate change, increased storminess, what does that mean for our capacity maybe to respond to other changes and shocks to do with, you know, the economy changes in, you know, agricultural pricing and things like that. We need to always expect surprise, but also recognise that surprise is often quite helpful because we can't predict everything. We have to learn how to deal with uncertainty, and surprise might provide windows of opportunity. They might provide just the sort of chance for new things and novel things and innovation to happen. We need to keep options open because we're going to need a whole range of different things in the future, different strategies, different types of governance, different types of technology, different types of science. And we're going to have to be much more adept and adaptive. So we have to make sure that we don't get locked in and that we have the options to change our strategies as we go along. We need to have this idea of polycentric governance, you know, which is that we need to make sure that the rules and the institutions and the government that we have works across scales and talks across scales. So think about all those comments that people made about actually people further up at higher levels of government aren't listening to us, decision makers don't listen to us. We need to find ways of making that communication, both up and down, work much better. And finally, we need to really highlight the sense of place and identity, because those, I think, are so critical for especially community resilience. And at the moment, we don't really have a kind of adequate framework of integrating those into how decisions are made and how priorities are set. And for me, this is, as a researcher, this is a kind of whole new area which I think is just sort of opening up, and it's about saying, well, how does things like sense of place, people's sense of belongingness, you know, their ties to a community, to a place, to a landscape, how can we build on those for change and to build this capacity for change, and how again does identity, cultural identity, occupational identity, identity in many different dimensions contribute towards that as well. So I hope that that sort of fits into the discussions that you've had about culture and heritage and sustainability. And I mean, thank you all very much, but the question that I would really like to ask you is whether or not Cornwall is resilient.
Rob Follett, Falmouth Local Exchange Trading Scheme, but also Transition Falmouth, and I was wondering how much you were aware of what the transition groups were already doing in these areas, with the addition of the factors of peak oil and relocalisation in particular. Peak oil being more of an interest in climate change, probably is interested in what comes out of the exhaust on your car. Peak oil is more about what goes into the petrol tank. So, I mean, as a driver for self-motivation, people get an interest in that. I think that's an important factor as well, resource depletion and the like. And the four scenarios as well, they're very similar to David Holmgren's work on permaculture, and also Rob Hopkins of the transition movement.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I do know the work of the transition movement, and I've spoken to various people regionally and nationally, and worked a little bit with the Transition Research Network as well.
And aware of the local group, Transition Falmouth, Transition Constantine, Transition Cornwall, Transition Lostwithiel. There's several local groups in Cornwall, and they were really some of the first adapters of all of this stuff as well. So we've been doing a lot of this stuff for about 7-8 years, and we greatly appreciate more input at our meetings.
Well, that's great, and I'd be really interested to talk more with you, and I think the way in which the transition movement is using these ideas and ideas about resilience in a really grounded way, and in also a very radical way, to sort of challenge assumptions about, as you say, energy and how energy is produced and consumed and things. And so I think, the transition movement is a fantastic application of these ideas, as I understand it anyway. So thank you.
Yes, I agree. Oh, sorry. I agree with Rob.
Just get your name, sorry.
Oh, it's Andrew Ormrod here. Yeah, I agree with what Rob has been saying. We do have this weakness because we're at the end of the line, and things, obviously, with supermarket supplies and things like that, we've seen what happens in bad weather. But it's also energy. Even energy storage, there's a lack of it in Cornwall. And this amazing vision, which is fantastic, is... if it is feasible to go back to smaller scale, but resilience in terms of having a localised, jobs in all sorts of areas. How possible that is when you've got competition against economy of scale from very large organisations, manufacturing, is a very interesting issue. But it would be very interesting to see, and maybe it fits into something around the bioeconomy.
Thank you. Junie Tamblyn, founder member of Transition Lostwithiel and founder member with Rob and others of Transition Cornwall Network, and now with my language school in Lostwithiel, which I've created myself, a space in the community to teach Cornish dialect, critically important for identity here in Cornwall, Cornish language and Cornish literature. I think of this in two ways now at the moment. One is, how resilient is Cornwall as a space, as a place, but also how resilient is each of us in our own lives? Are we, when we make decisions in our lives, thinking about our own future resilience and how that fits into the whole? And to what extent is what we're doing and what we want to do what people need around us? So I think, how resilient is Cornwall, and how much responsibility is each and everyone as adults taking for our position in this, so that we can carry our own weight as much as possible in the future and therefore hopefully help those around us to the maximum? Thank you very much.
Just a very, very brief thing, and sorry, it's a bit Lostwithiel-centric. One of the most fantastic events and it's a real crowd puller in Loswithiel, is when some of the guys who grew up in the 1930s, they either do a tour around the town or talk about it. It's where all the shops aren't, where the abattoir isn't, where the market isn't. It's a bit like, you know, Totnes, you know, looking back from the future. But it is fascinating to see all this. And, you know, for well, even the likes of me, it's very hard to understand. All this resilience was there and it's all gone. But how do you get it back?
If I could just respond to those really great comments, thank you very much. I mean, for me, you know, your comments sort of underscore two things. I mean, the first is this sort of cross-scalar thing, you know, that actually, and that's why I like that Rockefeller Foundation definition, because it says it's about individuals, it's about communities, but it's also about broader systems and, you know, the importance of sort of working across those scales. Because in response to, you know, the other comments in a way about, you know, self-sufficiency and resilience. I mean, when I worked on some similar issues in Orkney in Scotland, you know, really interesting narratives came out about how communities in these small islands felt very resilient. But the whole issue about self-sufficiency, and so, you know, we asked, well, what happens if the storms get so bad that actually daily ferries, daily flights, all of that, you start getting cut off from mainland Scotland? And people said, well, you know, it might actually be quite good, because in the old days, every island in Orkney had its own bakery. And now we don't have a single bakery in Orkney, and we have to, you know, fly everything in. Everything comes in on the ferry. So actually those things about what can you foster locally that are going to build resilience but also stimulate local economic activity, skills and all of that, I do think there are some of those things. But I also think there's the big problem of actually, you're still, you know, being driven within a system which, yeah, you're marginal from, and that there are some real structural constraints. But that mustn't stop things happening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.